Accession number 29566, Reel 6.
Inspector Reel 6.
After about 4 to 6 weeks, we got our first leave, which was a 48-hour pass. So we thought, oh, great, you know, we're going home. Bit of relaxation. We were told that we had to be back in barracks by what they used to call 11:59 hours on Sunday evening. So we were given a travel warrant. This one was a return to go home and come back. So we went home. I had a good couple of days, met a couple of mates, did the usual things, went out for a drink, I think we went to the pictures. I slept quite a bit. I can remember my mother saying to my father, I must have been in a semi-comatose state, because I can remember flaking out on the sofa at home. This was on Sunday afternoon, prior to going back. And she said to my father, do you think that he's getting enough sleep, because he's been there for a couple of hours already? Anyway, we got back to Liverpool Street Station, and one trick we used to use at the station was when we boarded the train, as I've explained earlier, this was in the days of steam when all the carriages had independent compartments, and about six of us would get into a compartment, and just prior to the train pulling out, we all used to crowd up to the window to give the impression from the outside that the carriage was full. So people would walk along, look in, walk past, and then once the train had started, we had compartment completely to ourselves. We used to bring out, you know, the sandwiches and the cake and stuff that mother had made before we left home. And then we got back to Colchester in plenty of time, sneaked past the guard room, because the guard room was quite a frightening place at Colchester. There was always regimental police outside, and they were absolute pigs, and they would stop you for anything, both going in and coming out. It was the same as the big stations at that time. They were all swarming with military police, and they would always pull you up and want to see your pass and where you were from or where you were going, and they were a law unto themselves. Complete, you know, I've got one stripe on my arm, so don't give me any problem, laddie.
And I take it that you would always travel in uniform in the room.
Oh, yes, yeah.
When you went home for your leave, did you change into civvies at that point?
Once we got home, we did, yeah. But you always had to return to barracks in uniform. It was only when, and this is going on after I finished my service, when we were doing TA, I used to travel up to one of the big stations in civvies with my uniform in a case, go in the public toilets, change into uniform, and then go and do my weekend or 14 days or whatever, and then the same procedure coming back. Go into the loos, change out of my uniform into civvies, and come home in civvies.
You mentioned the regimental police there. Did they have a reputation, regimental police, really?
Regimental police were quite nasty bits of work that we found. They would try and pick you up for anything.
And are they drawn from the regiment?
They're usually drawn from the regiment or the base that you're at. I mean, we had them abroad. We had our own regimental police.
Do they differ from, say, like Colchester? You know, when it's your own regimental police within a unit, is that different from sort of regimental police who are at a depot?
Yeah. They're quite strict, regimental police, of a unit, but they don't tend to take as many liberties with you because they know you, or they know of you. But regimental police at a training depot don't know you from Adam. You're just another soldier to them, and they are real pigs. They can be real pigs.
Would you smarten yourselves up before going through the gates then?
Well, usually you're inspected before you go out. There used to be at Colchester, on the front of each barrack block, a big mirror. And you used to be inspected in the barrack room by the NCO if you were going outside of camp, who used to go through you like with a fine tooth comb. And then if you passed his muster, you would then form up outside, and then you would stand in front of the mirror and you would do any final adjustments that you thought you needed to make. So it wasn't very often that you were pulled by the regimental police, unless they felt in a bit of an arsey mood. But they would pull you over. They would say, "Where are you going?" Or, "Can I see your pass?" Anything just to stop you. They might say, "I don't like that, do that, and do that, and whatever." But they were quite nasty, some of them.
And at the depot, would people be allocated to the regimental police, or do they volunteer for it?
Usually, they were regular soldiers, because most permanent staff at a garrison training depot are regulars, and permanent staff are there all the time. So they may be volunteers within the training establishment, or they may have been assigned. But I would say in the main, they could have been. You see, when you go to a training establishment, at the end of your training, before your posting or just prior to your posting, some NCO might come round and they will say, anybody interested in joining the military police? Those that are put their name forward and they go off to the military police training establishment. Not all of them make the grade, some of them don't, and they're referred back to unit. A lot of people that were turned down for military police come back to the depot and enlist in the regimental police.
So would you say that it attracts a certain type of soldier?
Yeah. I would say they've got to be, they want a feeling of power, because that's all they seem to have going for them, really. They've got one stripe on their arm, because I don't think, in the main, well, all military police, the lowest rank is Lance Corporal. There are privates in the regimental police, but it's like having a hidden stripe. You know damn well that if you cause them any bother, you're almost bucking a stripe. So it's best not to aggravate them too much.
One of the other things, while you were in basic training, did you do any kind of physical exercises?
Now, this is another thing that we must talk about. As the days passed and we gradually got into the routine, there was PE every day. This came as quite a culture shock to some people who'd never done any physical exercise in any shape or form. I mean, speaking personally, I was lucky. I'd always been very heavily into sport. Cricket, football, as I've mentioned before, semi-pro, standard, county badminton player, although be it the second team for Essex. And to me, sport was my life, really, and physical exercise didn't worry me at all. So I sailed through physical training. It was wonderful for me. In fact, I must admit that there was a time at Colchester when I was thinking of applying to become a PTI, physical training instructor. But I think at that time they said they didn't have any vacancies. I think my main trouble was I voiced an opinion during one PE exercise that didn't go down too well. I was very short, and most PTIs have got at least another 3 or 4 inches on top of me. But my main problem was I have always been a great opponent to boxing. Because at school, when I was at school, we had a PE teacher who was very into boxing, and he would just pick kids out to put the gloves on and bash the bloody living daylights out of one another. Well, I didn't like getting hurt, and I just didn't see the point of inflicting pain on others. And at one meeting we had in the gym at Colchester, they asked for members who were into boxing to join the garrison boxing team. And when it came round to us, I foolishly stood up and said that I thought, well, I gave my opinions about boxing and what I thought about boxing. And my application to become a PTI was turned down more or less on the spot, because most PTIs are quite proficient boxers, so I didn't get the opportunity. But that's, by the way. But PT, or PE as they called it, I found quite interesting, exhilarating. They ran us ragged. They had us split into groups of about eight, where we used to literally carry telegraph poles from one end of a football pitch to the other, and then we used to swap sides, left, right, left, right, and we used to run everywhere with great weights, and just to get you really top-notch performance.
Would you do sort of stretching exercises first, prior to doing that sort of thing?
Yeah, you used to do all the usual stretching exercises, deep breathing what they used to call warm down was done at the end of the whole procedure. But they had us going over all sorts of obstacles. The assault course, they introduced us to the assault course. They had us doing that from very early on. And it progressed as the weeks went on. You did it in PE kit, then you did it in uniform, be it denims, then you did it in full kit with your pack, no rifle, then you'd do it with full pack and rifle, and you'd climb up all these wonderful bits and pieces that they'd got
What were they constructed out of?
Were great big like rope nets that you used to go up and wiggle your way across on a single rope, over great big tanks of muddy water. Then you used to go into big tunnels which were half submerged in water. You used to hold your breath and go along, traverse these things and come out the other end. You used to be covered from head to foot in mud and muck, and when you got back to camp you had to clean all this lot up, not only you, your kit, your rifle. So it was quite exhausting, but as time went on, you got fitter and fitter and fitter. And I mean, I always thought I was fit, but at the end of 12 weeks, I'd never been as fit in my life. I was top quality fit. Most of the other blokes were the same as well.
Did you do any kind of route marching in that first 12
weeks? Yeah, yeah. You used to do the knot. That again was done first of all in PE kit, and you used to cover a certain length in a certain time, but it was gradual. They built it up week after week, so you would start off, you weren't timed, and it was just a gentle jog, and then it was more of a march. And you'd always have NCOs at the back of you and at the front of you, either helping you along or giving you that extra incentive to push. I can never ever remember, though, anybody dropping out. I can never ever remember a lorry, an army lorry, being in attendance to take anybody back to base because they were so knackered. Everybody managed to get through it.
What kind of distances would you cover?
You were doing, you started off mile, 2 mile, three. I think the most we ever covered in one stint was a 5 mile.
And were you expected to keep a certain pace with that at that period?
Yeah. Gradually towards the end, as you marched en bloc, as it were, a platoon.
And were you doing that in full kit?
You were doing that in full kit. Full kit, yeah.
Did anybody have any problems with their feet in anything like that?
There may have been one or two lads with blisters, but on the whole, I think most people seem to get through it.
Because I was going to ask, obviously, with something like boots, with your generation, were you more used to wearing boots?
No, I wouldn't say so. I think probably when we entered the forces, boots was probably the first time we'd ever worn boots of that sort of calibre, you know, the big hobnail boots. But no, I think on the whole, most people acclimatised to their boots very well. I mean, they get very supple after a few weeks.
And with that whole process of the physical fitness, you've said that by the end of it, you were the most fit you've been.
Super fit.
Was that the case with everybody? Were they all getting that way?
I would say 8 out of 10 people were top notch. You got the odd one or two who just couldn't hack it, and they were sent down to another camp for building up. Or if in some cases, not very often, I only ever came across it in one case, where they couldn't hack the PE at all, they were called what was called back squadded, which meant they went back so many weeks. It wasn't a punishment as such, but it was a way of trying to build them up. So eventually they did all come through.
What was the problem there? Was it that he couldn't keep the pace?
A lot of in a lot of cases there were a few chaps grossly overweight. You could tell them apart. You know, they were what we would know as puppy fat, but in an 18-year-old lad. Who was just a bloated chap. I mean, perhaps through no fault of his own. Perhaps not like the kids of today. Some of the kids of today who are just constantly on convenience foods or just, you know, a bag of blubber who sit, watch telly or play games. There was much more emphasis on lads getting out and playing sport in the 50s, late 49, 50s. I mean, I think all my friends and mates of that time, they were either all playing cricket or football. You were never in. There were very, very few lads who weren't partaking in some sort of sporting activity. And I think there was a generation who were fairly slimly built because of what they did or what they ate, were just never fat. But there were the odd one or two.
And you say they were back squatted. Was that just to give them the opportunity to get a little bit more weight off and become fitter?
Yeah.
So it was actually giving them extra time.
Extra time, yeah, and a bit more extra training. But they weren't sort of put in a class that, you know, they weren't demonised because of it, you know. They weren't sort of given the rough end of the stick. They were just given more time to build up.
Sounds very organised in the sense of how that, although you weren't being treated as individuals in a sense, there was actually an awareness within the squad of individuals.
Yes, because at the end of your training, the first 12 weeks, you were assessed. In fact, you were assessed every day. all the way through. The platoon sergeants had to fill in reports. These reports went to officers. Officers, quite often, if you were on exercise, or on the assault course, or on the range, or anywhere, you would see one or two officers dotted around the place, and they were all making notes. They would be constantly referring to their sergeants and NCOs, and there was your name and the list, and it would have proficiency, rifle shooting, brain gun, PE. So you were all being marked as probably how proficient you were all the way through, or where the weaknesses were. Should you be back squatted? Should you be sent down to the PE establishment where they built you up? I think you got more food or more protein or whatever, and they gave you more exercises. You know, there were times when you had to pull yourself up on a rod, like, and also get down and do so many press-ups. Well, if you're completely new to that, or you've never done anything like that, after a couple of these things, you're well and truly done for. Well, as you're doing this, you might be able to do three the first day, you might do four the next day, five the next day, and over a period of time, it gradually builds up until at the end, when the proficiency test comes along, because you all have to pass a proficiency test at the end. You may have a day on the range where your proficiency with the rifle is tested. So you know damn well if you want to get a bit more pay, you've got to try your best and shoot good on that day. Same with the brain gun, same with PE, same with everything else. And even at the end of 12 weeks, some of the larger lads, shall I say, just couldn't do it. You're given a certain number of press-ups to do. You're given a certain number of pull-ups to do. And if you didn't meet that, you failed. You might pass everything else, but you might fail your PE. So you went back and you did a bit of a stint so to build you up a bit.
During this period, had you only been at practice at all?
Ah, yes. Bayonet practice. Now, somewhere around, there's a little story about bayonet practice. We were introduced, these were the big bayonets then, not these little tiny pikey things that they have. We were shown how to put the bayonet on. This is all part of your drill. But then,
how does that attach to the
You have to, on certain words of command, you have to place the rifle between your knees and grip the rifle between your knees like that. And on another word of command, you smartly turn to your left where your bayonet is in a scabbard. And on another word of command, you pull it out. And on another word of command, you clip it onto your rifle. And then you take your rifle and you put it down with the side. So you can imagine an old Lee Enfield, which is already about 3.5 foot long, with another 18 inches or so of cold steel on the end. And these things are flashing about all over the place when you're doing shoulder arms and present arms and all this nonsense. We were told that we'd have to be taken down to another type of range where we would be doing bayonet practice. Now, bayonet practice is quite fun, really, if you're that way inclined, because all you're confronted with is a wooden trestle with a big sack on, full of straw, and it's got like a Guy Fawkes face on, with a tin hat or something or other, and a couple of legs, and you're told to charge at this thing and scream and shout any obscenity that comes into your head. You can F and blind and you can do anything you like, as long as you make plenty of noise. And if you don't make plenty of noise, you have to come back and do it again. And you you keep doing this, you go round and round in a circle. There's one bloke following another bloke, round and round and round, and you're running at this target with the rifle and bayonet at full stretch, with the bayonet, the rifle butt pulled right into your side, and you're screaming and yelling, and you plunge this thing into the middle, and you twist, and then you put your foot on it, on the figure, you kick the figure and you pull it out, and then you turn to the right or the left, and you run past the target, and you go around in a circle, and you do it over and over and over again. And then if the NCO doesn't think that you're doing it properly, he might stand in front of you and say, "Lunge at me, lad, lunge at me." And of course they know all the tricks. As soon as you do that, they knock it away. But they want you to swear and scream. And
is that to get your... Well, to quite simulate what you'd be doing if you were in reality?
I think it's twofold. It's that, and also it's to frighten the hell out of who you're sticking the bayonet into, hoping that he will get up and run. I must say, I've never been in a bayonet charge. I wouldn't want to be in a bayonet charge, and I think it is the most disgusting thing ever. I can't imagine sticking a bayonet in there, anybody. Now, I've shot at people, and that's not the same thing, because you're over here and he's over there. But no, not. I wouldn't fancy sticking a bayonet into anybody. I wouldn't say I couldn't do it if the occasion arose, but even then, it struck me as being the most disgusting thing ever.
Sounds as though the training was quite fun.
Yeah, that was quite fun. Yeah. And the other thing that we were taught to do was throw a grenade, but that isn't very exciting at all. They give you a 36 mils bomb, a hand grenade. They teach you how to unscrew the base plate and put the primer in. And then they take you on the grenade throwing range, and they tell you to pull the pin, throw it, and just get down, and it goes off into the sails, off into the distance, and explodes, and that's all there is to it.